Well, good afternoon, everyone, for what is always a very highly anticipated session. My name is Michael Anderson, a partner at BDO, and I'd like to welcome James Campbell, director from the banking and finance team at the tax office, and Rhys Chalmers, director of financial services and the GST team down in the, also with the tax office from Melbourne, to what is often, as I said, quite at the afternoon session for the conference, which is the ATO bringing us up to speed in terms of its current areas of focus with regards to financial services. If I could ask just everyone to make sure that their phones and other machines are just on silent, and in terms of any questions throughout, we'll take questions at the end if that's all right. Please submit any questions you've got through the app. Otherwise, we can take questions by hand if we've got time at the end. But without further ado, I'll hand over to James, and thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. And yeah, really appreciate the opportunity to speak at this conference again. I think it's been a really good conference, a lot of good topics, definitely I think a lot of things that cut across different elements of the industry. And I think safe to say when we talk about current areas of focus in financial services, there's definitely quite a lot of topics that we could speak about today. Probably dozens, but in the interests of getting into a bit more detail and making it a bit more meaningful, we've decided to hand select some particular topics, hopefully some that probably have relevance to a lot of advisors, a lot of taxpayers and other stakeholders. And I always think that'll make it more meaningful and useful. And I always think it's useful for the market to get as much insight as possible from the ATO, and I think really the way I look at these things is in terms of what we're thinking, especially where we might not have a final view, because I think that's often a common scenario we're in the ATO, where we've started to look at an issue, we've been looking at it for a while, we're kind of thinking we're probably going to land on a particular view, but we're not quite there yet. You know, if it's something where there's an area of concern, you know, trying to be pretty clear on what we think that concern is, to make it real for you guys. And if we don't know, we don't have the answer, we'll just say that. So in terms of some of the kind of income tax and withholding tax topics that I'll step through today, I don't think I could do a session without talking about a couple of these topics. So the first one is really where we're at with this whole world of debt deduction and the new definition. Just to give you guys a bit of insight, and particularly I think from, you know, the fact that we've looked at more and more fact patterns and I think especially within this industry, a focus around kind of hedging and trading of swaps and derivatives. Obviously there's a lot of different angles you can come at with debt deductions, but that's I think a particular nuanced topic for this industry. The change in definition of financial entity, again that one is a little bit more narrow. Obviously, it's not going to be relevant to regulated banks and ADIs. It's more of an issue for kind of non-bank lenders, non-bank financiers, but still is very relevant to a lot of taxpayers, and definitely one that we've had a lot of, I think, requests from the industry and from taxpayers on in terms of certainty and guidance this year, and there's a few PBRs in the pipeline. And then finally, maybe a good tangent for those that were in John Fulton's withholding tax session just earlier, but I will unpack some of the current areas of concern in relation to the public offer test in 128F. Not a new provision, something that's been around for a long time, but something where, you know, now and again, there's change, there's evolution in the market. We have a look at things. We probably have to mow the lawn a little bit and just let people know that we've got concerns out there. And I might also touch on just some of the new work that's happening in that space at the moment with some potential PAG in the pipeline. Rhys will step through some current focus areas in relation to GST apportionment, and some of those issues relate to things like the cost allocation process, some of the current common errors that come up in that world, the Hanover decision, and looking at some practical examples. If I don't have slides on this, but if I have a little bit of time at the end, I wouldn't mind also touching on a new draft PCG that was published just a couple of days ago, which is dealing with the attribution of risk-weighted assets to foreign bank branches in Australia. Again, something that's going to be very relevant for the foreign bank group. So we might get straight into it, and as we often do at these conferences, you can't go through one of these technical topics without doing a little bit of a recap. So kicking off with debt deductions, the definition is in 82040, so that provision's been around for a while, but obviously been amended. It's going to have, this topic's going to have relevance to a lot of taxpayers, debt deductions, so my focus today is more on this industry, but it definitely has relevance across the board. The bill was passed on the 27th of March 2024 with royal assent on 8 April 2024, and the amendments apply in relation to years starting on or after 1 July 2023, but obviously, particularly in this industry, we tend to have a lot of different year ends, so you can see the relevant dates there for the other year ends. But I think one thing that I should point out is it's not new now. If you're a junior end, you would have already been through two tax return years, two lodgement cycles under this new definition. So just maybe taking a step back to the explanatory memorandum and touching on, I think, some of the key points that are relevant to the issue that I wanted to touch on today. We need to remember that this amendment is on the back of trying to embed OECD best practice and approach into our legislation and trying to achieve a more kind of global common concept of interest into our legislation. And really what it's trying to achieve is to ensure that the legislation captures this concept of economically equivalent of interest, which we'll touch on in a sec because it's kind of directly in the legislation. This whole world of swaps is obviously very interesting, and it's come up a couple of times at this conference already. The EM is pretty explicit on its intention to include costs in relation to swaps, and it specifically refers to interest rate swaps. Now, interestingly, it doesn't provide an example or talk about FX swaps. I don't think that necessarily means too much, and we might talk about that a little bit later, other than the fact that there are a lot of different kind of swaps and derivative transactions that happen in the marketplace. And I think the other really important takeaway is this issue that the costs don't need to be incurred in relation to a debt interest. So again, the EM was very deliberate that, hey, the amendments are going to make sure that happens. And look, I think in some ways that obviously makes a lot of sense for taxpayers outside of this industry where swap-type transactions are more of an unusual transaction in just managing some specific types of risks. But we'll also talk about the fact that for this industry, it can be quite a big thing because it can potentially drag in cost in relation to trading type businesses where it might have no relationship to your debt funding of your balance sheet. So just having a look through the three key sections in this provision and what the legislation looked like before and after. So when we look through section one, you can obviously see the left-hand side is what it looked like before the amendment, the right-hand side is after. And you can see that the removal of the term in relation to a debt interest issued by the entity. Again, I just spoke about that in terms of what was in the EM. And you can see what has been included, which is calculated by reference to the time value of money is replaced with economically equivalent to interest. So that's the other big change. Not much changed in section two. It's largely the same, except for the change in the debt interest in paragraph C, and that has changed to a debt interest just to broaden the scope of the application of that provision. And now section three, I kind of look at as a pretty big change, I think, especially for this industry. And we can see, you know, before the amendment, you had that paragraph A, losses and outgoings directly associated with hedging or managing the financial risk in respect of the debt interest. So that is gone. And under the old law, this was making it abundantly clear that losses on swaps and derivatives entered into to hedge or manage financial risk in respect of debt interest, I think that's important, were not included. We would generally think of financial risk as covering risks associated with interest rate movements and FX movements. So I think that's an important thing to think about. And look, I think it's important to say that, you know, this amendment, this particular amendment in this section, was needed to try and achieve the policy intent of ensuring what is caught within the thin cap net for potential denial of debt deductions can align with the true cost of debt financing your Australian operations. So I think we've really got to have a think about it from that perspective when we were looking through the provisions and when you're thinking about your own business and how you approach thin cap. And look, I think thinking of that, again, probably a bit of a generalisation, but for a lot of taxpayers in this space, you know, you're really looking at floating AUD. You know, if you want a proper hedge, and if you're running a business in Australia, your main source of funding, what you will want ultimately in terms of your cost will be floating Aussie dollar. Now, guidance, ATO guidance in and around debt deduction. Nothing kind of too groundbreaking either before or after the amendment. Now there's a couple of things before the amendment dealing with some very specific issues. Now, being a good ATO officer, I will point out that ATO IDs are not binding, but I still think, you know, we release these edited versions for transparency. And look, I think, you know, if you look at it carefully and you can make your own judgment call about how similar your fact patterns are to that, I think you can get some insight out of that. There was this ATOID 2003-973, which looked at a specific type of convertible notes and basically came to the conclusion that the periodic payments on that convertible note were debt deductions. Again, I don't think that means that's going to be the case with all convertible notes and definitely not kind of anymore when we move into the new legislation. There is a TD, which is 2019-12, and that is dealing with, what type of costs of debt deductions within the scope of subparagraph 820.40.1A, Roman numeral 3. And again, that is a very specific subparagraph that, the TD provides a list of examples of costs that are, and I think it's important to say the way that subparagraph is drafted, directly incurred in obtaining or maintaining the financial benefits received or to be received by the entity under the scheme giving rise to the debt interest. So it's trying to capture particular things. I think it is interesting that this TD effectively is almost a copy and paste of a list of items that are captured in the EM, and it captures things like cost of tax advisory services, establishment fees, restructuring fees, stamp duties, regulatory filing fees, legal costs to prepare documentation, essentially kind of focusing on and including costs incurred prior to the establishment of debt capital or after the or just after the establishment of the debt capital. So it's really kind of pointing to those items. At least I think it is very practical and very clear cut. I think it is interesting, and again, thinking about where we're at now, that in this compendium to that that PAG, there is some commentary around foreign currency hedging losses, and stating that they are indirect costs, as the losses relate to commercial risk mitigation strategies, and are not directly related to the obtaining or maintaining of financial benefits under the debt capital. The direct relationship is with the hedging instrument. So basically saying, again, this is in the old law, that FX losses on swaps are not direct costs in relation to that the debt instrument. I do find that interesting, and I think when the new legislation came out, I did wonder whether there was an argument that you could get all the costs in relation to interest payments, particularly on FX, could come in under that provision, but that's not what it says in this TD. Now, in terms of more recent PAG and kind of more broader guidance in terms of even things like web-based guidance since the amendments have come into effect, there's a couple of different items that that largely talk about interest rate swaps. So I think we kind of do interest rate swaps to death when you go through all the different guidance that we put out. Not always directly on point on that, but there's commentary around interest rate swaps. So the first one, and this has already been mentioned at the conference in another session, was TR 25.2, and that's really focused on the third-party debt test, but there's a lot of relevance in that in relation to transactions involving interest rate swaps, and we just make a lot of explicit comments that, yeah, they're absolutely in the game in terms of debt deductions. There's also practical compliance guideline 2025-2 that is dealing with restructures and the thin cap and debt deduction creation rules. So again, its focus is a little bit different. There again is some commentary in there around interest rate swaps, and there is an example in there that involves some recharge costs that are kind of on the back of interest rate swaps, and effectively saying that in that situation, in that particular example, that can also be a debt deduction in terms of the recharge costs. We also do have, and I think it's pretty good, I do think it's pretty useful, a broader part of our website that is dedicated to all the thin cap amendments more broadly. So I would encourage people to have a look through that. There's not a lot that's specific there on debt deductions. I think what is insightful at the moment is some of the commentary that's in there around what our focus and priority issues are in relation to the amendments. And again, you know, my day job and my lens is really kind of banking and finance industry and the specific issues that come up through stakeholders and through fact patterns that we look at. But it's safe to say that within the ATO, there's bigger headaches in relation to these amendments. And you will note that issues like debt deduction and even what I'm going to talk about later on financial entity don't feature towards the top of the list in terms of matters, immediate matters of priority for PAG. What is mentioned in that page as matters for priority might not be a surprise for people, but it does talk about the interpretive issues around restructures, the third-party debt test in general. And again, we've just mentioned some PAG that's already been released on that. And I think importantly, the interaction of the transfer pricing legislation and rules and the new thin capitalisation rules. So, one of my battles internally is to try and get some of our issues, up the priority list. But I think even at a more practical level, I think we often, we would all love formal PAG, because of the more binding nature of some of those products and the formality of it. But if we don't have a realistic chance of getting something like that in the immediate future, to use other avenues and methods that are available to have the conversation, talk about things and get the view out. And I've already talked about some PBRs. I'll talk about some PBR work that's happening in a sec. And again, scope to kind of learn through those PBRs, communicate messages to the market. I've always been a big fan of getting as much correspondence out to the industry associations and the firms as possible. If I think we're in a position where we've got a view, it's pretty safe, it's not controversial, and we can all move on. So now, just touching on a few different examples in this space, and again, these are really a handful of examples within this whole world of debt deductions, and they're really more focused on swaps and derivatives and hedging risk management transactions linked to debt issuance, along with a little bit in relation to some branch structures and trading operations. So, so I'm not going to comment. Maybe one point I will make, and we can maybe talk about this at the end if we've got time in the Q&A, but I'm not going to comment on issues in and around TOFA or calculation issues, particularly the issues around net versus gross payments. That question's already had a Guernsey at this conference. And I'll just focus on the key baseline fact patterns in relation to swaps and derivatives in this space that you might need to consider as to whether, hey, I've got an arrangement here that could spit out some costs that I need to add to my debt deduction pool. So you can see in this example, it's pretty straightforward. It's a very common one that comes up from time to time. You've got Ausco operating within the Australian market, and it has issued fixed rate notes to raise debt finance. So it's in Aussie dollars. It's in the right currency that it needs, but it's done it in fixed, maybe because it's had a good opportunity at a good price to do that. Now, in order to hedge to a floating interest rate, Ausco enters into an interest rate swap with a third party. And I would say in this case, the true cost to Ausco, the true economic cost to Ausco in funding its balance sheet is really AUD floating. And we would say that, yeah, the costs in relation to, or I should say costs in relation to interest payments on the AUD fixed notes will definitely be within scope for debt deductions. That's very straightforward. But the new definition is also going to bring in costs in relation to the interest rate swaps into the definition. They're absolutely economically equivalent to interest, and there's no exclusion now in the legislation for hedging or risk management transactions like this. And this obviously appears to be the baseline scenario with swaps that was intended to be captured by the amendments to the definition. And as I mentioned earlier in the EM, it does explicitly say that it is intended that interest-related costs under swaps, such as interest rate swaps, are included in the widened definition of debt deductions. And I think before leaving this slide, obviously I've given a real-life example where you know there is a debt instrument being issued, which with some hedging in relation to the fixed for floating. But we need to remember that it doesn't even need to be hedging the interest rate risk on the fixed notes to be in, and we'll touch on that a little bit later. So in this example, this is an example in relation to third-party FX swap or forward. So another type of risk that needs to be managed by taxpayers in this industry and other industries in relation to debt issuance. So in this example, Ausco needs additional funding for its business in Australia. It has an opportunity to raise USD funding at a good rate, and issues USD floating rate notes to offshore investors. As Ausco needs AUD to use in its Australian business, it enters into an FX swap forward with a third party. So the big question is, what amounts fall within the definition of debt deduction in this scenario? Now I would say, look, this whole world of FX swaps and the definition of debt deduction, to me, is probably the biggest issue facing the industry and the ATO in relation to these types of fact patterns. And when I agreed to present here, I was kind of hoping we'd have a final view on this by now, but unfortunately we don't. But I think we're kind of edging towards that. I've definitely kind of spoken to a lot of people in industry, and I think there are a lot of different views around. There's been some good papers and commentary issued by some of the different firms. What I did think I could talk about, which I think will add value to this discussion and this debate, is I think a good way to start in unpacking this this issue around FX is to separate out FX swaps and forwards that have nothing to do with interest payments. So you might, for example, be a business and you have an FX swap or a forward relating to something like the payment of dividends or payments to a supplier. Well, costs in relation to this type of stuff just wouldn't get into the definition of debt deduction unless there was something very contrived going on, and we might even have to consider anti-avoidance payments, anti-avoidance rules for some of those types of situations. But what we're talking about this example is an FX swap forward in relation to interest obligations. So there's a swapping of principal and then there's interest payments from US dollars to AUD. So it's not miles away from the concept of interest. And the key issue here is whether the costs in relation to the swap of the interest payments, whether that's a net amount or a gross amount, are debt deductions. And I'm really hoping the ATO can come out with a clear final view on that shortly. But yeah, there's absolutely an argument that that should be in. I also would say that I think in a lot of ways, if we're talking about a more economic outcome or the policy perspective, it is a fair argument to say that it falls within the policy intent. You know, facts in this example point to a taxpayer that has an economic cost to its debt funding in AUD. The thin cap amendments want to try and make sure the true cost of debt funding are caught within the thin cap rules, and in this case it really is like a floating AUD exposure. So this example again is really just a combination of the two. So it's where debt finance is raised by the issuance of US dollar fixed rate. So it's both in OSCO needs AUD funds in its Australian operations and has a desire for floating rate exposure. OSCO enters into this cross-currency interest rate swap to get an AUD floating rate exposure. The costs in relation to the USD fixed notes are absolutely within the scope of debt deductions. And now you kind of get into this world of, well, if we don't land on a view that the FX swap costs are in, then we've got to try and apportion out the different elements of the interest rate swap and the costs on the FX leg. So that's going to be the trick. If we land on a view that FX is in, then obviously the whole thing's in. But if we don't, taxpayers are going to have to look to separate out the different costs. And again, I'm not going to talk about how that may be done. I think that definitely is a discussion for another day. So moving into a bit of a different type example, but with some similar concepts, this example is trying to illustrate some of the considerations in relation to branch structures, especially with inbound structures with a PE. And this is an example that we see from time to time in the foreign bank sector. You've got offshore co, and they've raised some cheap funding through euro fixed rate notes, and they've made that available to the Australian operation. Now, obviously, the internal payments are allowable, and it would either be under Part 3B if you haven't elected out, or we allow recognition of those for taxable income under TR 2005-11. Again, I think the key concepts here are very similar to the previous example, except in this example, the Australian branch is hedging back with offshore co, which in reality might actually be another regional branch. So the example is probably a little bit simplified. And we would expect the costs associated with the internal euro fixed rate loan to be treated as debt deduction, along with the relevant costs associated with the internal cross-currency interest rate swap. To the extent of the messaging I provided in the previous example around FX. So this example is now moving away from the presence of a debt issuance, right? So we're now just looking at client trading business that involves interest rate swaps. We could talk about other types of swaps as well. So in this example, we have interest rate swap arrangements that are not associated with hedging interest rate risk on a debt issuance. And we've got to remember that's how these new amendments work. So the interest rate swap transactions are simply related to the bank's client business. So it's client trading business, providing risk management solutions for clients. As you can see in this example, the risk associated with the interest rate swap with a client in Australia is ultimately hedged for the global group with the market via and offshore PE. So you can see there's a transaction in Australia, there's an internal back to the offshore PE, and then it's hedged out to the market. You know, in this example, it looks like it's all kind of traceable and one for one, but we know that there would be some portfolio management happening there as well. Look, this is another scenario that I think has presented some uncertainty in the industry due to there being no debt issuance. And I think what worries me a little bit is some taxpayers talking about this example and having a view that surely this shouldn't be in there, there shouldn't be costs on these transactions in there. But as we mentioned earlier, we don't need that connection to debt issuance. I think at a more practical commercial level, you probably think, shouldn't it all really be hedged anyway? And there shouldn't really be much of a true outgoing. I would say yes, if we look at things from a net perspective, but if it's on a gross, this is probably one example that probably raises some concerns about that interpretation. So I might leave it there for debt deduction. As I said, really hoping that this calendar year we get some clear views out, particularly in relation to the stuff around FX. Now, just moving into another specific topic in relation to the amendments, and that was the change in definition of financial entity. Now, as I said earlier, it's not relevant to regulated ADIs. It's more non-bank lenders, non-bank financiers where this is an issue. The definition is in 995. The bill was passed on the 27th of March 24 with roll assent on 8th of April 24. And again, like I said, with debt deduction, the amendments apply from 1 July 2023 for income years starting on or after. So if you're a junior end, you've already had 2 years in this world. I would just say as well, my talk on this definition isn't going to focus on paragraphs B and C of this definition, which have remained the same, and they are really more dealing with things to do with securitisation and other trading operations, sometimes an easier way to get into the definition. Yeah, apologies for this, there's a lot of small print here, but I think it's another useful one to go back to the EM to some extent and have a look at some of the key takeaways there. You know, for the old definition, financial entity really piggybacked off, like purely off the Financial Sector Collection of Data Act. And there was an argument put forward by government, the architects, that there were entities that were registering with only a minor amount of activities associated with the provision of finance. So, registering in that act, there was no requirement that there's this massive amount of provision of finance activities happening. And, you know, I think that got to a point where some of these cases were raising integrity concerns. And some of those integrity concerns related to the fact that the asset-based tests were generally more favourable to taxpayers compared to the new earnings-based tests, which only apply to general class investors. I think it's important to emphasise generally because I think depending on the facts in the case, that is not always necessarily true. And the additional condition in paragraph A to introduce this concept of being a business of providing finance and the requirement that this is pretty much all you're doing. It states a term, all or substantially all, is adopted to cover circumstances where all the entity's profits are derived from that business but accommodating other minor or incidental profits. I think that's a pretty big statement in the EM. Here's the before and after with the legislation. You can see on the right-hand column the additional elements that have come into the definition. I spoke about business of providing finance. It also includes this idea that you can't be doing that on behalf of an associate like a parent. You've got to be running the business yourself. Now, this slide could probably be an entire presentation at one of these conferences, but I think it is important to note that, and maybe annoyingly so, there are a lot of similar but different definitions and terms throughout the Tax Act. So this was just a stock take by me of some of the different terms I've personally dealt with in my job in the ATO in 12 months. And I kind of won't go through all of this in detail, or we'll be here till midnight, but just quickly, the first one is business of lending money, and that is to do with bad debt deductions, and that's in in 2535. It also is mirrored in the TOFA provisions in 231.80. We then have the financial institutions exemption for interest withholding tax in the DTA in 11.3b. And again, that's another slightly different definition. We've obviously got this one. We've got financial entity. We've got financial intermediary business in section 317.1. We've also got banking, financial or other similar business in the hybrid mismatch provisions for principal purpose test. And 128F also brings in this term of a business of providing finance. I think the key takeaway here is that we can learn things from these other provisions, and I'll talk about some of the PAG in a sec, but they're all a little bit different, which does make it tricky. And one issue I have dealt with is taxpayers contacting me and saying, I tick one of these other boxes, am I in for financial entity? And a lot of the time it's like, not necessarily. So just in terms of some of the pre-existing PAG that is around, and probably more linked to these other concepts that I mentioned. Again, you need to be a little bit careful in looking through these, but I think there is some really good insight that we can get from some of the terms in this new definition, from some of this pre-existing PAG. You know, definitely 2005-5, which is in relation to the DTA exemption to interest withholding tax. I think there are some good takeaways in there. In terms of learnings, and look, I would encourage people to have a look through this in your own time. I think we can learn a lot, and even internally, we're learning a lot from some of these other PAG products in terms of developing and fine-tuning our view. I would also point out the fact that with financial entity, we are now, I think, onto our third application for private binding ruling. We will try as best as possible to get edited versions out, and I've listed some of the authorisation numbers there. And again, look, treat it with a bit of caution, but I think you'll get some good insight from some of these PBRs, and I think we'll get some good insight that'll help us to finalise our view on some of the key issues. So what I might do now is just step through some examples. Some of this has come out of rulings work. Some of it's come out of some other interactions with taxpayers, just to illustrate where we're at in terms of some of these different interpretive issues. So in this first example, we've got an entity that's undertaking mixed business, right, which is going to be one of the more problematic scenarios for this definition. And you can see in this example, again, it's pretty basic, but the taxpayer is deriving, it's 70% of its income is coming from finance. So we could just summarise, say, from the provision of finance. And 30% is from other income. It could be some sort of advisory thing or something that's nothing to do with the provision of finance. So it is important to note that we're dealing with this phrase, all or substantially all. Right, and our view from an interpretive perspective is that is a very, very high bar, right? So putting aside any kind of policy debate on this, it's a very, very high bar, and this entity just wouldn't get into that definition. It's important to distinguish it from the financial institutions exemption, which uses the phrase substantially deriving its profits, and in TR 2005-5, people would know that you look at that ruling, you look at what we've done in practice, and we're generally okay if you get to 51%, right? So I think that's a really important interpretive element. I think the next fact pattern is this whole world of, you know, the legislation's pretty specific. It talks about profits. Does that mean we just go to the P&L at the end of the year and go to the bottom line and work out whether we meet the test or not? Well, we would say no. We would say the P&L is an important factor in determining this, but you can see in this example, we've got ABC Finance Co. It pretty much is just doing provision of finance, right? If you look at its numbers, and here we've got some P&L figures. But unfortunately, there's been this crazy abnormal year. It's made a $100 million loss in its finance business. It's doing some other piddly thing on the side, and it's actually made a $50,000 profit for that. You know, we would say that that doesn't detract from this entity meeting the definition. And we would also be conscious that we don't want people flipping in and out of the definition from year to year on this basis. So that's the way we would look at that issue. This issue, I think, is still a little bit of a controversial one and one that we need to do a little bit more work on within the ATO. It's touching on what is really a very common scenario, and it's been a common problem for ThinCap from day dot, the idea that you've got a consolidated group and there are different things happening in the consolidated group. You know, for this definition, you need a registration for Financial Sector and Collection of Data Act if you're coming in under the first element of that definition, and you need to be business of providing finance. And in this example, head co isn't, operating co one isn't, but operating co two is. So what does that mean? Does everyone need to be registered to be in? Well, we would say no. Is it enough if one entity is registered? Well, yeah. And that entity needs to be doing the financing transactions. I think what we're still a little bit sure on is, and I think this is where you can get some really bizarre outcomes, is do we test the operation, the whole operations of the TCG, if you get in with one entity, or are we purely testing just that entity that is registered and that we think on its own meets the definition? There's definitely some history in this regime that would make you think it is just that entity. You think of the issues we've had over the years with the ADI rules. You've got an ADI subsidiary in a group, it drags the whole group into the ADI ThinCap rules. I think it is a bit different here. We've got a current case with this fact pattern and hoping we can resolve that shortly and get a clear view out to the market. Just conscious of time, I might speed through the next couple of examples. But the key principle in this example, you've got Offshore Co. It's got an Aussie subsidiary that's truly engaged in providing loan finance to the market. That's basically all it does. What we're trying to point out in this example is, in this example, OSCO doesn't raise third-party debt funding. It's just getting all its debt funding from its parent. Is this a blocker? Is this a detraction from getting into the definition? We would say no. The reason why some people think it's controversial is we've said things in the past under the financial institutions exemption in the treaty that we want to see third-party debt funding from financial markets, because the phrase in the definition specifically refers to that. But it doesn't say that here, so we're okay with this type of fact pattern. And then a little bit similar to that previous example, this is dealing with the whole issue to do with on behalf of. Okay, so Offshore Co's got a sub in Australia. It's dealing with the market. But we have a look at the facts and we can see, hey, there's back-to-back loans for every individual client deal. Every deal is getting big levels of approval from the parent, and there's not much risk borne in Australia. We would start to question whether you get into the definition, because you're not really undertaking the finance business yourself. You're doing it on behalf of your Offshore Co. Obviously, these fact patterns are going to be, these scenarios are going to be very fact dependent. So it is hard to kind of give too many definitive views here, but please, be mindful of that when you're looking at these types of arrangements. So might now just move on to a totally different topic, and that's just some key takeaways at the moment with some areas of concern that we have seen in the market over the last 12 months in relation to 128F. I would say these concerns in some cases are pretty broad reaching. They're not, you know, necessarily specifically targeting this market. The first one is in relation to arrangements where we think there might already be an arrangement agreement or understanding in relation to taking up the offer. It's pre-arranged. We look at some of the facts that we see, and we can see things like there being a limited amount of time, you know, some pretty interesting terms and conditions that would point to it being pre-arranged and it only being taken up by a particular party. So that's something to be aware of. I would say there's definitely been a lot of this in the private market that has been happening. The next example is looking at some risks we've seen around associate arrangements. Important to remember the definition of associate takes its meaning from 318, and it goes much, you know, further than just, you know, ownership interests and control from that perspective. You know, that is what I've presented here in the example. Obviously, this would be pretty out there, not that say that we haven't seen this before, but you can see in this example, OSCO wants to issue some debentures to raise some debt finance to acquire an asset, and it's done that with an entity that is part of the same control group globally. I think the key point I'd say is be mindful of broader principles around associate, particularly with sufficiently influenced, and the BHP case in 2020, I think, has a lot of precedential value in terms of understanding how broad that concept can be. And then the final issue is in relation to the type of instrument. So where we might think that the instrument being issued or the product is not a debenture or debt interest. The definitions, I think, are interesting in 128F9 and 6.1. They list a lot of things. You kind of look at it and think what's not listed, but it isn't everything. And some of the instruments that we've seen more recently, more down the deposit end of the product spectrum, would raise concerns for us. I think we do need to do a bit more work about some of these products, particularly the ones that are tradable, but some of the NCDs we've seen recently and looking at their terms and conditions probably do cause us some concern. So on that note, I might pass over to Rhys.
So I might start with the question of how long is a piece of string? You know, and it's not dissimilar to the question of what is a fair and reasonable apportionment, a GST apportionment methodology. You know, without context, you can't answer, you know, the question. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. Not anything new in terms of GST, but perhaps a bit of an area of concern that we're seeing, that there is a growing trend that we see a small number of taxpayers trying to justify their GST apportionment methodology to the commissioner by simply referring to that their methodology is fair and reasonable. And that if the commissioner cannot deconstruct or deprove that, then whatever ECP rate is determined on based on that model, that's appropriate to claim the GST costs in relation to. So I'll go through a couple of examples of why that's not the case practically. Maybe for context, what will be fair, what will be appropriate to the commissioner for a GST apportionment methodology? GSTR 2006-03 specifies three overarching requirements. Yes, it needs to be fair and reasonable, whatever that means, and yes, it needs to be documented. But most importantly for the purpose of today is the concept of that the methodology chosen needs to reflect the intended or actual use of apportionable costs in question. So to paraphrase that, whatever proxy you're using to estimate your GST recovery, it needs to be, you know, appropriate in terms of measuring how costs are being consumed, you know, in your organisation for making different types of supplies. So how does one go about establishing that with the commissioner or self-assessing? It all starts with the cost allocation process. So four principles to consider in this respect. The commissioner always wants to see taxpayers trying to do a direct allocation. If you know an expense relates to a particular type of supply or supplier, you should treat it accordingly for GST purposes. The more sophisticated you are at being able to do this, the smaller the bucket of apportionable costs in question, which means that there's less materiality of risk given if you've got something wrong with your methodology, and, you know, less motivation for the commissioner to spend resources, you know, reviewing those methodologies. Now, not all costs can be directly allocated to suppliers, but that is not the same as saying that, you know, all those apportionable costs then fall into this overhead undifferentiated bucket. You know, many organisations will know where a material value of their expenses sit within the organisation. So it might be in a particular area, division, you know, product line. So notwithstanding, you might not be able to directly allocate those costs to suppliers. You can probably assess them very close to the suppliers in which those types of expenses are consumed in making. And that's going to result in a much more accurate estimate of your extent of credible purpose recovery rate. It's also going to be much more defendable if you're interacting with the ATO. Now, the third principle is you need to appreciate the nature of costs that you are suggesting are subject to apportionment. And this principle is vital because the commissioner is going to want to interact with this whenever he's dealing with taxpayers. So, you know, such questions that we might ask as, you know, provide us a top list of 50 transactions that are subject to apportionment for the year, or top 20 vendors, or list the GL accounts. So the Commissioner is trying to obtain a high-level understanding as to the nature of the costs, and also, at the same time, trying to determine if there's any weaknesses in your cost allocation. So if, for example, you saw significant marketing vendors or material commission costs that can only relate to an input tax financial supply, those costs are inappropriate to be in the apportionment bucket and should be removed. So the fourth concept is then, what methodology are you going to pick? Now, it is true, the Commissioner has got a lot of guidance on different approaches that can be adopted by taxpayers in his rulings, and there are judicial instances of different methodologies. All that is true, but that does not mean that just because the Commissioner has a specific methodology that has been found acceptable in one instance, that that's appropriate for all taxpayers or all circumstances. You still need to meet that preeminent requirement of being able to illustrate that the methodology you have chosen is accurately reflecting how costs are consumed in your organisation. And that's probably best done by a couple of examples. So first off, a tax example, we've got Aussie Widgets. It is a subsidiary of a widget-making machine manufacturer. And it does two things in Australia, Aussie Widgets. It sells widget-making machines to third-party dealers, so a taxable supply, fully recoverable. And it issues finance to retail consumers, so that's input tax, 0% recovery. Aussie Widgets is able to allocate 90% of its costs directly between one of these two activities, but 10% is in want of apportionment. Now, before we consider that, I've got a jar of jelly beans. Notwithstanding the comment from the Second Commissioner, this is a serious conference. I know this is a non-tax example, but for illustration, it's made up of two colours, black and red. And let's say, for argument's sake, I'm entitled to the proportion of the jar represented by the black colour, and you are entitled to the proportion represented by the red. Now, we can't just tip the jar out and rifle through it and separate them individually. That's going to take too long, and who wants dirty hands over the jelly bean? So we need to develop a methodology, to apportion that jar. So back to Aussie Widgets. We get told lots of commercial metrics around 93% of revenue is derived from taxable supplies, and 90% of directly allocatable costs relates to the same, and there's a 4-to-1 ratio of unfinanced to finance sales of widget making machines in the hands of the dealers. And Aussie Widgets then says to the Commissioner, well, all this is objective commercial information that reflects my operations as a business. I am referring to your ruling in which all these methodologies are talked about at length. Dear Commissioner, there can be nothing but a fair and reasonable approach for me to look at this, and in so doing so, look to claim 80 to 93% recovery on my apportionable costs. Now, for the jelly beans, what have I told you 74% of people preferred black over red, or that there's 3 times as many black jelly beans as there are red in the world, or that there's twice as much resources expended in producing one red jelly bean to that of a black, so a 67% favourite for an ECP purpose. I would put to you that when we're splitting out this jar, I want at least 2/3, if not 3/4, of the jar of jelly beans. Could anyone fault my reasoning for being unfair and reasonable, objectively speaking, to actively disprove it? I wouldn't complain if you couldn't, but you then look at the picture of that jar of jelly beans, and there's a lot more red than black beans. In fact, I've poured 1 packet of black and 2 packets of reds. So you're being shortchanged if I'm sticking my hand out for 2/3 to 3/4 of that jar. That is not reflective in the context when you look at it. And that can be the same for the frustration for the Commissioner when we're dealing with taxpayers that are talking in abstract about their methodology being fair and reasonable. In the hypothetical case of Aussie Widgets, if we know that 80% of FTE is allocated to making input tax financial supplies, then to the extent that you've got significant costs that are consumed by headcount, so, rental of premises to house your employees, leasing hardware, Microsoft licences, you're going to have to apply a very low ECP rate to those particular types of costs. If you're applying a high one, that's not reflective of the context. Equally, technology and communication costs. If we know 99% of the number of customers are retail chattel mortgage holders, it seems remarkable to suggest that you want to allocate 80 to 93% of your technology and communication costs to that very small 1% of dealer customers. Finally, this room would know better than most. Financial products can be very complex and indeed highly regulated instances. You know, there's no TIA conference for widget making machines, for instance. So when you're looking at professional fees, if this is making up a large portion of your apportionable costs, how are they being consumed? Surely they're weighted to your much more sophisticated and complex part of your organisation in supplying, you know, these highly regulated loans, as opposed to the simple activity of distributing widget making machines. And that gets to the crux of the point that, you know, taxpayers, when you're assessing your GST apportionment methodology or interacting with the commissioner, you should always start, for the sake of context, at your cost allocation. Be able to articulate what you're doing, where costs are being allocated within your organisation, and identifying the nature of the things that are left for apportionment. Once you've been able to do that, you'll be able to instinctively, hopefully, look at the nature of the costs and determine an appropriate proxy that reflects how those costs are being practically consumed in your organisation between the different supplies. Now, starting with this concept of my methodology is fair and reasonable, Commissioner, and it falls in with some of your guidance, it's kind of like trying to measure the metaphorical piece of string. It just isn't very accurate, it isn't very helpful. So, thank you.
All right, thank you, James. Thank you, Rhys. It's, as ever, been very insightful. We've got a couple of minutes, so if there's any questions, I might just ask around the floor. We've got nothing on the through the app, so does anybody have any question from the floor? Doesn't... Oh, yep.
James, you said at the start of the time you talked about the risk-coded assets.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, John. Yeah, so, look, I don't have any slides on this, but... PCG 2026-1 was published this week, so I think it was a couple of days ago, and that will be out for an extended period of consultation. It's dealing with an acceptable approach to the attribution of risk-weighted assets to Australian branches of foreign bank banks. So that's a tax decision within the inbound ADI ThinCap method statement. Now, it's something that we've been grappling with the industry for quite a while now. We did have a technical discussion paper out a couple of years ago. So when you have a look at this draft PCG, you'll notice a lot of the concepts are taken from that, but we have moved in the direction of a traffic lights PCG for people that like those types of PCGs. You will also notice that it's probably got two key takeaways, this PCG. One is that the expectation from the ATO is that the attribution of risk-weighted assets will be driven by the location of economically significant activities that are associated with the creation and ongoing risk management of the risk-weighted assets. And I think the second thing that's probably a bit new is there's a bit of a bigger emphasis around evidence and record keeping and a linkage to the record keeping provisions in 820/960, right, which have always been there. They apply for all purposes of the Act, despite the fact they sit in the ThinCap provisions. So I'd really encourage people, whether you're an advisor that work with the foreign bank community or you are a foreign bank yourself, have a look at that. Be part of the consultation. I was talking to AFMA a couple of days ago, and we might set something up to have a chat about this with the broader market. So thank you.
Matt.
One of the stated policy reasons for the ThinCap rules was to raise revenue. How are you measuring whether or not revenue is being raised, particularly in the FS sector, that has had to, you know, change around that definition of financial entity?
Yeah, look, that's a great question, and unfortunately, there are minds greater than mine in some corner of the ATO doing that. And I don't think I can provide a lot of insight into it. I would say I think it is tricky with these provisions because, like I said, it's not new. They've been in for a couple of years. But I think in terms of gathering the evidence, a lot of it will unfortunately come through casework. It takes a lot of time.
Are you seeing more deductions disallowed on IDS?
So, look, I would say, like, in kind of my space, in the lens I look through, which is heavily around the regulated space and some of the other non-bank lenders, I would say not so much in this market.
All right, well, look, we are running very much up against the time, and I did want to thank James and Rhys, and in particular to thank James perhaps for his contribution over a number of years. James is actually moving out of the banking and finance team at the tax office into international tax structuring. So again, for your contribution over a number of years to the Tax Institute's Financial Services Conference. Thank you, James. And please, can we thank James and Rhys? Thank you.